welcome back. This is the second part of the story, and this is the part that I was setting up for with the whole glider incident, the whole car failure, not trying out for basketball again, talking about my failure with the trampoline incident. How it all relates to photography is that it's really important for you to be there and to be at bat. I think all too often we're looking at trying to hit home runs, and you got to be careful. Home runs are great. Home runs, when they happen, are memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that you remember. But those aren't what win games. What wins games is, RBIs, right? And low ERAs. I'm talking about not any
right.
one single game. It's over the whole season.
Yeah.
It's how you make the playoffs. It's not just hitting home runs. It's all the other little things that come together. It's why Moneyball can work.
Right.
So the reason I bring it all back to photography is because I think we too often try to hit home runs. We too often try to look at the big wins. But it's that persistence. And I wanted to try to call something else. I really wanted to try to call it don't give anything. I was trying to come up with anything other than don't give up or persistence, because I don't like that bullshit, right? It's just so trivial. It's just so cliche, overused. It's played out. But fuck, it's what it comes down to, because if you don't try that second time, if you don't try that third time, if you don't persist, that's what regrets are made of. It's
right.
not persisting. It's when Winston talks about wishing he had never quit hockey. And I know he didn't say it, but I know I know he wishes that he never quit being in the band trying to achieve that dream, because he doesn't get a second go around.
I'm sure he still thinks about it. I bet he thinks about both. It's such big parts of his life that he had to give up to do something else.
Is his life better now? I'm sure it is. It's certainly much more secure and consistent.
But what does that life look like?
But you gave up something. You gave up something to get that consistency and the security of having a job at a corporate office. And
it sounds cliche when you hear someone say that, don't give up. But when it's in the perspective of the person that's living that life, like when you know that you've seen it work, when you knew that you didn't give up and you made it through to the other side, you understand what that feels like. But people that haven't experienced that triumph after working so hard, you just hear it as cliche. So I think in that context,
they can't tell you the
sense.
Whole story.
Right.
You wouldn't have the time to listen to the whole story.
The personal agony to get to that point.
Exactly. Because it's not the home runs. They can't just tell you about the home runs. They've got to tell you about the strikeouts.
Yeah.
They've got to tell you about the errors. They got to tell you about all the bad things that have happened along the way. And so what's really more important than the home runs is, again, all those other little things. And in the stock market, if you only look at the highs and the lows, you'll go, wow, that's a big range. And then look how far this thing has come along. But then you're also going to get psyched out by mm-hmm. every day it's fluctuating up and down. And if you only focus on the big failures and the big successes, you're not going to see the trend.
Mm-hmm.
And the trend may be moving up or the trend may be moving down. We call that the moving average of the stock. And that's what's more important. Is it trending up? Is it trending down? It's not the big wins and the big losses. And I think photographers, like myself, we're too often trying to focus on just the one big thing, that one big breakthrough moment, when really it's a series of really small breakthrough moments.
Mm-hmm.
Developing
anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The examples that I wrote down, right? So very early on, I was obsessed with skin. This was Model Mayhem 2009, 2010, when the separation between a good photographer and a bad photographer was whether the skin looked real or not.
Oh, okay.
And back then, the cheap ass technique, or the rudimentary version of it, was you just blur out the skin so it looks like plastic, and then you just paint over where the skin is, and then you just put it out into the open and let people see it, because you didn't have a better way to retain the pores and mm-hmm. the realistic, semblance of that being actual human skin. So I spent thousands of hours researching on how do you preserve pores but also remove the blemishes.
Right.
So that was it was a huge separation for what made a good photographer and a bad photographer was how did you resolve the skin issues. And if it weren't for that, I don't think, well, first of all, I'd have a lot more time on my hands because I spent literally, you know, hours and hours and hours. I mean, nights on end just trying to learn techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one specific technique that was very complicated. On Model Mayhem, I believe it has 100 and some odd pages of responses back and forth,
mm-hmm.
because it was that technical. And it's called, for those of you that know, it's called the frequency separation technique. And it's basically an action in Photoshop or a set of actions or set of things that you do in Photoshop to separate out the pores from the, you know, the low resolution stuff from the high resolution stuff.
Okay.
And then being able to treat the little blemishes on the low resolution side independently of the overall skin tone of the person.
Going in and getting to do exactly taking out the parts that you don't need.
Just the parts that you don't need without destroying the fact that those are pores and mm-hmm. those are real, right? But still being able to get a few blemishes out of there. And then also resolve big skin tone issues where it's blotchy, you know, for example, bad makeup, you know, bad foundation or whatever, you know, suntan or sunburn or whatever, just bad lighting. So resolving each independently of each other and then fusing them back together. Well, that requires
a surgeon.
It's like taking the face off and then really working on and then putting it back on. Well, that required a little bit of Photoshop manipulation that took me a long time to not only learn but also perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, huge challenge, a massive challenge back in 2009, 2010. Do I still do it to this day? Not as much, because most of the time I can resolve the skin issues without going into that kind of precision.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of my beauty work that is all about the face, I still will go and use that technique. But I bring it up because if I didn't persist, I would have never made it through to the point where I was confident with skin retouching.
Yeah,
I would have still been blurring my skin and making it plastic looking just like anybody else. But because I broke through, I was able to separate myself and I was able to gain a lot of confidence in my own retouching techniques and also in my ability to learn something Photoshop, you know, something
like another language almost.
It is.
It's like a musical instrument too. There's so many things you can do. It's almost like a piano or a keyboard or something.
It is.
Countless, endless ways to do things with Photoshop. Like I felt like I knew how to use it pretty well after really researching and watching as many videos as I can and trying to figure out the things that I wanted to figure out how to do on it.
Yeah.
But I know 1% of what you can do with Photoshop. And right. Even now where there's probably three versions later that I haven't even worked on because there's countless, limitless things I can do with the version I have that I'll tap into just a small percentage of it.
It's certainly a endless thing. It's almost like you're just giving someone a canvas and some paintbrushes and some color and then say, hey, go do whatever you want. You can almost do whatever you want, quite literally. So, you know, that's one example where persistence does pay off, you know, and specifically in this is a photography example. And then another one that I feel like that I wrote down that I wanted to talk about was, you know, when we planned for the Zion trip, we were able to scope out all of our destinations without even being there.
Mm-hmm.
And have good plan A, plan B, plan C's. And the skill sets that I used to create that with was really a good knowledge of Google Maps, you know, looking at the terrain on Google Maps and Google Earth mm-hmm. so that I can get a 3D perspective of what's going on here. That's one. Then in conjunction with Picasa, which is the Google photo album manager or mm-hmm. photo manager, now I can also look at what other people have done at those locations.
Yeah, that was really cool. So, actually seeing where they were at that time when there's sunlight out, what it looks like.
Yeah, people take pictures out there, and now I don't have to have gone there to know what it looks like.
And a 3D perspective a lot of the time where you can actually see what... Yeah. That really helped, I thought, in Zion, because there's so many cool little spots that you would have to have someone go out there,
right.
An adventurer, and capture all that for other people.
Right. Like I remember seeing the Seven Sisters, the final place that we went to on the third day. Like I remember seeing that on the map, and I was at first a little leery that it was really right on the road and that too many people would be able to get to it. So a lot of things that we were thinking about were accessibility. First of all, is it easy enough for us to get to, but hard enough for other people not to get to?
Yeah.
That was kind of the cutoff point where that would make a good location for us because we're going to shoot some nudity and we didn't want to be exposed. But we also needed to be able to get there ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we approached it, our criteria. Also, beyond Picasa, Google Earth, Google 3D, or Google Maps was also looking at the weather, looking at the sun calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the sun going to be? Which way is it going to come? How windy is it going to be? There's extensive research and preparation that you can go without even setting foot there. And then once you do get there, you hit the ground running because mm-hmm. now I know exactly what this place is going to be like and how to work this location.
How busy it's going to be.
Busy it's going to be as well.
Yeah. How much sunlight you're going to get in that little canyon.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is something that I think, you know, to this day, it helps me. And it's funny because I started doing this back in 2007 when I used to work for a bank. And what we used to use this for was because I was doing commercial real estate underwriting,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these locations you have to go and see in person, but some of them are very far out. Mm-hmm. Palmdale, big properties, very, very far away. Sometimes you don't want to drive all the way out there, you know, and to get a really good idea of what that location is and what's around there, you mm-hmm. could just look at the maps. I don't need to set foot there to know that I can see there's a subway across the street. I can literally see it on the map, or I can tell you that this location is this, or I can tell you what else is around here. So as far as commercial real estate underwriting was concerned, you know, I mean, yes, it's good to go and set foot on the property too, but you can do a ton of research before you even arrive.
What information do you need at that job? Like when you're looking for that, what are the things that are like the keys to either buying that property or not buying that property?
It was, when we're lending to potential people who own these properties and they're trying to basically it's a commercial loan,
mm-hmm.
commercial mortgage, so to speak, you know. So it's people who have shopping strips, shopping complexes,
little retail
or whatever.
Centers and stuff.
Yeah, or in one case I think it was even a farm or something. It was like a large plot of land that was just sitting out there. But, you know, you do comparison work, you know, it's really any sort of, we want to make sure that the value at which we assign them and is accurate, because
yeah.
then we're loaning them a certain amount of money as a percentage of that value. If we screw up that value and then we loan them, you know, 70%, you know, of what that value is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're loaning them 100% accidentally.
Yeah,
you know?
What is that 70% really mean?
Because
yeah.
what if the real estate of that, the value of that property hits, you know, goes down and takes a tumble, and now suddenly it's worth less than that person owns.
Yeah.
We couldn't even sell that thing for that much money,
yeah.
which is one of the big fears of the real estate market today. So that was what was important. And then looking at what was around and making sure that the comparisons were accurate and making sure that our valuation of that property was accurate relied, at least for me, a lot on what was around that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that they were in a good neighborhood or there were other properties around that area that were equally valued. So you could drive around there, sure, all day, but it's a lot easier to look at it online and do research online. Mm-hmm. So that's where that skill set came from. And to this day, I use a lot of online research, especially when it comes to weather, wind, swell, whether it's surfing or whether it's flying, you know, airplanes, mountain biking. I can tell you, you know, we love a little bit of rain, not a lot of rain. You know, cycling, it also has to do with, you know, heat, weather, wind direction, if it's going to be gusty out in the hills. How cold it's going to be, what's the wind chill factor, you know, all those things affect your ability to prepare for the actual event, whether mm-hmm. it's a shoot, whether it's a loan, or whether it's a ride. It will affect and impact how well prepared you are for the actual event. So But yeah, that's being able to research all of that before going to Zion was a huge bonus because we didn't waste any time.
Right.
We don't waste time looking or driving randomly or aimlessly.
So many shoots that start like 2 hours later, even when they're simple. Even when you have the location, it's already there. You're on the third day of it, but you haven't done any prep. Like, where is this scene going to be? Where's the second location? I think that's stuff you see so much time wasted on set.
Yeah, and that's a hallmark of a poorly planned set or poorly planned shoot. And I don't, you know, for me, the expectations of how things are going to go are huge. If I think it's going to go well and I expect it's going to go well, I'm going to make it go well. And I'm going to spend the time and effort to make sure that my probability of success is good. I mean, I didn't go into that yesterday. It was just yesterday. I didn't go into yesterday not prepared. I knew it was going to be windy now. Did I know it was going to be that windy?
Right.
No, you know, I've never had that experience of 35 mile an hour gusts, you know. I mean, when the flag blows down, that's a bad sign, like I said. So, you know, I still planned for it. I ballasted my planes. I gave it an extra ounce, but I probably needed at least 5 ounces or 6 ounces, you know, or a half pound even to get those things weighted enough so it was not going to freaking fly away and do backflips accidentally, you know.
Say you have the same opportunity in 2 days.
I wouldn't go out.
You wouldn't go out.
No, because I don't have...
Same wind, planes ready.
The thing is, when I'm sitting at home, I'll make different decisions than when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm there, it's...
You're already in.
You're in. Yeah. You're pot committed.
Yeah.
Right? So... I'm going to make different decisions when I'm there because I'm not going home not flying.
Right.
When I'm at home, I don't have to go out there, and chances are I wouldn't make those decisions the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, the reason I wouldn't do that is because I don't have the knowledge of how much weight I need to put on the plane, nor do I actually have the weights to put on the plane, nor do I think that I can actually get those planes to be heavy enough to fly in those conditions. Those conditions are really, really severe and quite extreme.
Where's your line now? Like, what do you know how windy it would be where you're like, all right, I'm good up until this point from doing what happened yesterday, like feeling that wind?
Yeah, I would probably say maybe 20, 25 miles an hour. You know, okay. If it were 10 miles an hour or less. And also, there's wind and there's gust. The definition of gust is when there's a huge variance in the wind. It's like fast, super hard blowing, and then it goes down.
Mm-hmm.
When there's more than 9 knots of difference between the max speed and the low speed, that's technically gust. So wind is like consistent. It blows and it blows and it blows and it doesn't stop. Gust, it goes up and down. And you don't want gusts because gust is inconsistent. You can't plan for that. How do you know it's not going to do one thing here and then like 20 seconds later, which is the definition of a gust, lasting no longer than 20 seconds, that it's not going to totally disappear or even get stronger.
Mm.
You don't know that. So, I wouldn't go out there again, and I certainly wouldn't fly my planes. I probably would do it differently. But that's the learning experience. And the same thing goes with photography, is you do have to try. You do have to try and get that shot. You do have to, when you forget your camera, you have to try shooting with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're there. You have to do something. You can't just walk away. It's... You know, even if we'd gone out to Zion and those locations weren't what we thought we were going to get, and to our credit, they were every bit exactly what we thought we would get. I was never surprised. The only time we were surprised was at the lake when there were police officers, dive rescue teams. And
they looked very grim in the very beginning. I was nervous that the whole thing was going to be shut down because I thought it was a real investigation. I was looking, I thought,
yeah, it looked like they were like body recovery, you know, investigation, but it was just, you know, them training. Now, you can't, I don't think you can plan for that. How are you going to know that they were going to do that day? I don't have any inside information on that. You know?
Or if it was real, there's no way we could have used that location. That would have been a complete freak accident, that a fluke in that situation where there's no way they would have let us in if it was a real situation.
Yeah. Although that being said, I do think that we might have been able to look at the website for the lake, and then maybe they would have said that they were going to do some training exercises on that day.
Right.
So there are all sorts of ways to try to prevent that. But for our all intents and purposes, and as far as our research was concerned, we were spot on, and we very rarely had to go from a plan A to a plan B. Mm-hmm. I thought that we executed the whole weekend brilliantly, and it was all really due to having spent the time to research locations and and to find the right spots to go and then not waste time, mm-hmm. to drive to the places that we want to go, shoot it, and then we are done, we leave. It's graceful, it's fluid, it's efficient. And that's what I want out of my shoots. It's also what I want out of life in general. But the other thing is, I want to be obsessed. I want to go to sleep working on that problem in my mind. I want to think about the problem when I'm sleeping too. I want to wake up thinking about it, because it really, that is a very fulfilling way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my mottos, is like, you know, live obsessed, you know, be obsessed, because it makes you, when people are obsessed, they get very creative.
Right.
They come up with crazy solutions. That's why drug addicts, when they're itching for that, you know, to get that bump,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing they won't do. And that's what makes them also super dangerous, because you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know what kind of peril they're going to put their children in. You don't know what they're going to sell. You don't know what they're going to steal.
Yeah, what you're willing to risk to get that reward, whatever that reward is going to be. And how important it is to you is going to be that factor.
So obviously that's the negative side of being obsessed about something. But trying to get that, you know, finding that in your photography, what you are willing to.
What problems do you want to fix?
Yeah. Stay up all night. What problems are you willing to lose sleep over and spend thousands of hours trying to fix? You know, like at the time it was skin retouching for me, you know, or later on it was, how do you develop that analog film looking tech, mm-hmm. you know, that style, which a lot of my pictures, you know, in 2012, you know, 2013 represented. But that's what makes it so fun, because then nobody has to ask you to do it. You just do it because you want to do it.
Is there something in photography, like, where are you right now? Are you chasing something or looking for something to chase?
It is.
Or do you wait? Do you wait and see if it's something that you see naturally spark your interest? Can you chase something like that? Can you be on the lookout for something that you want to be motivated by?
In photography, I feel like I am chasing the chase, which is very a meta perspective of what do I want out of photography. For example, like historically, I've loved shooting nudes. Now, shooting only nudes has lost a little bit of that luster. So I know that what I'm looking for is something else to be obsessed about. Specifically as it pertains to photography. And I have a couple projects that I, you know, in my head that they're kind of still in the early stages, seeds that I need to plant and try to nourish that
and flush
to,
out,
to get it out. Yeah. But at any given time, I'm always looking for something to get really excited about, because it's kind of like how I was never single much before I was married. I'd always go from one girlfriend to another because I didn't like being single. It's kind of like that, in the sense that I want to go from one obsession to another and never fall from that excitement of being in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the lulls, that lack of momentum is really tough to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to get yourself from the lull back into the obsession mode, into something where you're excited about. It's really easy to skip from one thing to another because you retain that level of energy, excitement, persistence.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know it's a roundabout way to answer your question. I mean, for me, I like being on podcasts, telling the stories that we're telling, whether it's our own stories, like right now,
right,
or whether it's a story of a guest. I think that thing is driving itself in many ways. I'm really excited about that. And so that's why a lot of our attention and our time have gone towards that.
And there's so many different ways to do it. And it is a puzzle. Trying to figure out how to tell someone to tell their story with passion in a way that's very interesting to a crowd, but that might be scary to tell.
But I don't focus on the huge wins, and then also don't try to focus on the huge failures. It's really trying to do that every day a little bit, and just trying to push that ball forward, trying to thin out that envelope, that barrier, trying to make that barrier just a little thinner, so when it's time to punch through, you feel like, I can do it. I've got this.
Yeah.
I'm not that far. And so
tiny successes almost.
Tiny successes for me have been the hallmark of how I've even gotten this far, or how many, you know, how many times I've developed a skill set that is useful, whether it's retouching or coloring or styling or shooting or talking to models or teaching. everything has been built upon really, really small steps, not big grandeur. You know, people always ask me, what was your pivotal moment in photography? I don't have them. I don't have big, huge pivotal moments because that's not what I aspire to do on a daily basis.
Always in motion.
Little things.
Not wanting to be satisfied.
I'm a shark that can't stop moving because if I stop moving, I'll drown, mm-hmm. right? There's not enough water that passes through the shark's gills. So I want photographers out there to do the same thing. You know, find the thing that you're obsessed about. Find what you're willing to do, you know, and not go to bed until you get it right. Find what it is that you are willing to get that extra shot for and how mm-hmm. to get that extra shot. You know, find that one problem that you're willing to work on all night, all day, and obsess over, because those are the things that, going back to our last conversation, which as of this point we haven't released, but we will, talking about, you know, how do you get clients to see you differently? Well, you do have to be different. And when you're working on problems, like, I didn't aspire for my Counter-Strike server to be number one or two or three in the world, but I was, because it was unique. It had stats. It had anti-cheat. It had reserved slots for admins like me. It had a rotating map. Actually, it was one that was 24/7 dust. It was just dust, because that was the most popular map, and most people wanted to play that.
Oh, and that's the name of the map.
Yeah, it's called DE_dust. You know, there were all these things. I forget what else, but there were all these things that made that server. It was also a max server, 35 players. There are all these reasons why, comprised of little things.
Yeah.
You know, that made the server number one, number two, number three in the world. But I never aspired from day one to say, oh, I'm here to build the number one Counter-Strike server in the world. I wasn't. It was just a
side effect
product.
Almost. Yeah.
A product of a lot of little things that went right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's my mode of operation. That's how I do things. Is I would have failed yesterday. I would have lost my plane, and I would have bought another one today, and I would have been pissed.
Mm-hmm.
I went home pissed yesterday. After I crashed it, after I went home, when I called it quits, I was upset, because I'm like, you know, didn't have to be like this. I was still thinking, a small part of my brain was like, come on, we could do this one more time.
Mm-hmm.
Just one more time. One more try. We can get this. But the more logical side of my brain was, come on, your shit's all cracked. You're flying more tape than you are foam. You know, you got to go home and figure this out and maybe go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, and fight another day. You still have a plane. Day. You know, because, that's a big deal.
Because that is the overarching rule, which that's going to get you to tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whether or not I won yesterday against that wind is irrelevant if I cannot fly again today or tomorrow. It's more important that I'm here today, tomorrow, day after that. Because every day, as long as you're there, you're going to win.
You're going to get better, too.
Going to get...
You shoot more, you're going to get better.
Now, if, you know, talking about your hockey, you know, your friend who
learned
hockey in a quarter of the amount of time.
Yeah.
My advice to people out there would be, you don't have to take that much risk. Use time as your friend and learn smarter, not harder.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You don't have to break five bones to learn in that short amount of time. Go online. Go do research. Go simulate hockey. Go play hockey games. Go read books about hockey. Go
break it down. Just skating. Just learning how to stop. Learning how to do
go to the roller
puck handling.
Just learn how to skate backwards. Mm-hmm. Learn how to cross over. Learn how to do that with the stick in your
little
hand.
Successes.
Learn how to, I don't know if you call it dribbling, but basically
puck
handling backwards without an opponent in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Learn all those things, and then there's so much less risk.
Yeah.
You don't have to go and check people into the wall at 40 miles an hour.
You can learn those techniques,
to learn how to stop. You know, there's other ways to do it. So there's smart ways to win on a daily basis that I want people to go out there and try, rather than try to, again, there's no point in trying to butt your head up against the wall over and over again just to see a crack and then keep doing that. If that door's not going to open, there are other doors that you can try, other little things that you can try to succeed, whether it's photography or whether it's flying remote control airplanes. So that's the end of that. I want you guys to hopefully figure out what you're totally obsessed about. And I'd love to hear what you guys are working on these days. What is it that makes you totally, totally enthralled into in what you're doing. Because I think that's, maybe there's a trend out there. Maybe there are a lot of photographers that are switching over to something else, the next big thing. So I hope that was entertaining for you guys. I'm glad you guys stuck around and listened to the second podcast and heard what and how it pertained to photography. And let us know, and we'll talk to you guys all soon.